Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Squamish and Halkomelem speaking peoples. My name is Jesse. Today on the show, we're going to hear a grab bag of stories from here and other stations around British Columbia, and a little bit of music. And I'm going to be attending a professional development workshop while hosting the show. So you're not going to hear me talk too much, but you will hear, well, you'll hear recorded me talk and recorded other people talk. And also, as usual, a little bit of music. So we're going to start with that. This is local to Vancouver band Weird Hang from their self-titled demo EP. This one is called Heart Attack. Thank you. collection of artifacts documenting the nearly century-long history of the Riverview Hospital in Coquitlam and of mental health care in British Columbia is now accessible to the public through an interactive online database.
My name is Hilary Letwin. I'm the manager of cultural services for the city of Coquitlam. And the Riverview Artifacts Collection is an additional part of my portfolio as the manager of cultural services for the city. I have learned a lot about the Riverview Artifacts Collection since I started working for the city back in September. The collection was actually amassed and cared for by a nonprofit society for a number of years, the Riverview Hospital Historical Society. It was a group of very dedicated volunteers who had some sort of professional or personal connection to the hospital. And when it became clear in the 1990s that the Provincial Health Authority was probably going to be closing Riverview Hospital, this group of volunteers got together and started to create what they saw as a representative collection of artifacts from its time as a hospital. And it was opened in 1913, so that's almost a century of medical history, essentially.
This material history of British Columbian mental health care is not abstract or objective. It's fundamentally shaped by the people who put the collection together.
A collection is, of course, reflective of the people who put the collection together. So it was the Historical Society who did this work and determined what should be a part of this 2,500 object collection. And it is a cross-section, a sort of time capsule, really, into the history of mental health treatment in the province. It consists of about 2,500 historical artifacts. They reflect the history of the Riverview Hospital, which is located in Coquitlam. The artifacts range from medical equipment to furnishings, personal effects, and also kind of institutional items, crockery and uniforms and that sort of thing. In the minds of our team, it's really all about offering a snapshot into the history of mental health in Western Canada.
Beyond the larger, broader picture painted by the collection in its entirety, individual artifacts hold both a wealth of information about the institution and its operation, and emotionally charged insights into the lived experiences of patients and residents at the hospital.
For me personally, I find the personal effects most moving because those are items that relate to people's lived histories. And I think that those are extremely compelling. Coming from an art historical background as I do, I find the paintings and the other kind of craft materials that were created by people who lived at the hospital at different times in its history to be really interesting. There's in particular a painting that is a very iconic view of one of the first buildings that was built on the site that we know is a painting by one of the patients who was part of an occupational therapy program. And this painting was probably done based on a photograph that actually exists in the Royal BC Archives. The painting that I'm referring to is a landscape of the primary, one of the first buildings at Riverview. And it shows the building in the wider landscape with rows of daffodils. And it's painted fairly naively. It's not a complicated painting, but it is a really interesting personal connection between the artist and this place where they lived. We know that there were certain points in the hospital's history where the residents were asked or expected to make things that could then be sold to support the running of the hospital. So we've seen examples not just of paintings, but of embroidery. We also know that there was a working farm on the property where butter was sold from it and cheese was sold from it. So it speaks to the larger ecosystem of the hospital and how it was managed over its almost century of operations.
There are also stark reminders of mental health care's troubled history.
One of the more unique and perhaps difficult parts of this collection, which arguably is sensitive in nature, is that the collection holds 11 different electrotherapy machines, and these machines date from different periods. They're not just, you know, the same example of the same machine from the same time period. from a researcher's perspective, that's a really interesting snapshot of different medical therapies that were being employed. But for most people, it's less about the kind of academic side of things and more about the lived histories that are represented by these objects that people can learn from and take interest in.
While the artifacts themselves are impressive and a tremendous resource, Dr. Letwin is excited about a new way that interested parties can engage with the collection.
This new database that we just essentially made live at the end of 2024 is really interesting because it's publicly accessible. Up until this point, we had through our website a PDF that was a fairly diligent inventory of this collection, but a database offers our public a different way to explore this collection. So if, for example, one wanted to look up all items in the collection that were the color red, then you could go into the database and you could use red as one of those search parameters, something you couldn't do, obviously, in a PDF document, regardless of how thorough it was. The other component to the database is that it's a living database. We're really interested in gathering further information and further stories about the items within the collection. So if, and we would encourage people to do this, if people have more information about an item in the collection, we would love them to get in touch and to tell them about what they have to share and potentially be able to add that to the database. So it's a living entity that we can continue to add to and build on as we learn more about the collection.
Beyond providing access to residents of Coquitlam and the surrounding municipalities of BC's Lower Mainland, the database also provides a new opportunity for collaboration with a broader audience.
With a database, suddenly it opens up the collection to a global audience. We anticipate, judging from previous interest in the collection and also in the items themselves, we anticipate that there will be interest not just locally in the collection, but also much more broadly. And so far, we've seen people who have personal connections to the items in the collection get in touch, but we've also heard from researchers and academics who were interested in this particular portion of BC history for different reasons. And then finally, we have members of the general public who recognize that this collection holds lots of different types of artifacts that are cross-sections and time capsules for many different industries.
To explore the Riverview Hospital artifact collection yourself, visit riverviewhospitalartifacts.ca.
We are excited to offer people a deeper opportunity to explore the collection more through the database and are looking to gather stories related to the objects in the collection.
From Coquitlam, for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, I'm Jesse Wensloff reporting. This report is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and can be found online at frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca. Broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Home of Macfog the Dog.
Reporting from Port Moody, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. On January 14th, 2025, two members of the BCSPCA gave a presentation at a Port Moody City Council meeting that expressed the SPCA's issues and concerns with mobile petting zoos within the Lower Mainland. In their presentation, Kristen Jacob, a specialist in farm animal welfare, and Nadia Zanakis, a specialist in wild animal welfare, provided council with information that detailed the health and safety risks that these zoos not only pose for the animals in them, but for the public at large. Only a week after this delegation, a decision was made by Port Moody's Governance and Legislation Committee to ask that city staff create a corporate policy that would ban these zoos from operating in the city. CJSF was able to get in contact with Nadia Zanakis, the BCSPCA's specialist in wildlife animal welfare, who first presented to Port Moody City Council to discuss the SPCA's concerns with these mobile petting zoos. During our discussion with Zanakis, we first asked her to expand on the animal welfare concerns associated with these zoos.
Yeah, so we were invited by the Port Moody City Council to provide a presentation on the animal welfare concerns associated with these events. So they're just looking for kind of testimony from experts in this area to provide more information. And so the risks with events like these are to animal welfare for the animals themselves. So risks to their psychological and their physical health. So these events are very stressful. They usually feature exotic animals, which are just wild animals from another country. So we don't usually think of animals like raccoons as pets or companion animals. But when we see kind of reptiles or parrots or animals of that nature, essentially that's what they are, just wild animals from another country we've brought into Canada that are used for these events or used as companion animals. And so that's not really part of their natural habitat. It's very hard to meet their five freedoms in captivity. So there's a lot of concerns for their welfare at events like these, where they may not be given time to rest. They may constantly be being handled either appropriately or inappropriately. They can be stepped on. There's a lot of risk to their physical safety as well as a health and safety component for people. So there's a lot of mixing of animals and humans. That's a risk for Salmonella, E. coli, and we've seen avian influenza heavily featured in the news right now as well. So those are all kind of risks, including physical risks as well. So some events can feature larger mammals. Animals can be unpredictable when they're stressed. They can shed pathogens more heavily when they're stressed. So it's just kind of a mix of a lot of risk involved with these events.
Afterwards, Xenakis expanded on some of the public education work that the BC SPCA is advocating for, as well as the need for better standards in regards to wild animal welfare.
Yeah, we are constantly aiming to kind of provide education, seasonal education, as things pop up in the media. Servals, for example, usually have kind of an annual appearance in the media when one escapes and perhaps they are loose in an area and they might be attacking kind of outdoor cats. We really try to use opportunities like that to spread awareness about these issues. And really what we're advocating for is the Controlled Alien Species Act is provincial legislation. It's a negative list currently. So it means that it only lists the animals you cannot have. But the problem with that is there's new animals popping up all the time with trends and kind of new pets or animals that people are interested in having. And we can't keep up with kind of updating it to reflect the changes that are happening at the time. So servals, for example, aren't on the controlled alien species list. So people can legally have these animals, and as we've seen, there's issues with that. So what we're advocating for is a positive list. So instead, we would list only the species you're allowed to have, and it covers everything else. So you don't have to worry about kind of new trends popping up and having to update the legislation. And we think it would fill a lot of gaps that way. So that's one thing that we're advocating for. And we're hoping that we can continue to work on this.
Lastly, we asked Xenakis to give her thoughts on the City of Port Moody's recent decision to look into the banning of these mobile petting zoos. Here's what she had to say.
Yeah, we think it's fantastic. So Port Moody is really like a championing leader in this space. They're the first to kind of pass kind of legislation like this. And I think it's an important first step to start having these conversations, and maybe others might want to follow suit. But there's a lot of work that kind of needs to go into this issue. So from a municipal level, this is a great, fantastic step, and we're so thrilled to see it. But there's multiple levels of government that could be involved in this. So we are also advocating provincially to the provincial government as well for stronger restrictions on these types of animals.
Once again, that was Nadia Xenakis, the BC SPCA's specialist in wildlife animal welfare, who gave her thoughts on the City of Port Moody's decision to look into creating a corporate policy that would ban mobile petting zoos from operating in the city. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
In love. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hi, everybody. I am Rebecca, and I'm the public affairs intern here at the station. And today I'm joined by
Sanjay Jerem,
Who is a political science professor. Here at SFU. And we're just going to talk a bit about student voting and kind of the engagement that students have with voting, since I did a bit of coverage for the provincial election that just happened, and talking to a couple of, like a handful of students on campus about how informed they felt, how much they felt that they were targeted and heard by candidates. So to start off, do you want to maybe give an introduction to yourself, a bit about you?
Sure. I did my doctorate in political science at the University of Toronto. That was a long time ago at this point. I've since been a professor at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, before I came out to Vancouver to take the job here. You know, I used to work more specifically on immigration politics in sort of regional jurisdictions, but I've broadened since then. I teach mostly now in research methods, but also in broadly in Canadian politics. And that's been more of my interest now is Canadian political ideologies, Canadian public opinion. I do lots of media on those issues, and I've also continued to sort of have a small research stream on those issues. So yeah, I'm kind of really an all things Canadianist at this point.
Wow, it sounds like you've really dabbled kind of all around politics then.
It's been dabbled, but there's a through line. Probably it would take longer to explain that through line, but
Do you find you end up gravitating more towards provincial or federal kind of research?
I think that the literature in political science and the media pull you to federal politics because there's more demand. And there's also more, you know, in academics, it's similar where, you know, there's certain research tends to catch people's attention and people seem to enjoy, just like federal politics research more. But there is definitely a push to do more on the provinces, understand them, because there is a lack of research on provincial politics in Canada and understanding amongst the public. I would say that, and to be honest, my goal is to teach a course on provincial politics in the future and to teach on federalism because of that and try to do more, you know, to try to push myself further in that area, even though it's a little bit harder because you have less of an audience, right?
So. Yeah, because I'm from England, so I came over here and got involved in, like, covering provincial politics, and it took so long for me to wrap my head around it because the system is quite a bit different from back home and trying to understand it. And I was thinking, like, if I was a student here and I see how kind of overworked students are over here compared to how I find it at university back home. And I was thinking, I don't know if I would be able to sit down and wrap my head around the provincial side of things, let alone federally. So I was wondering, from your perspective, what issues do you think from the provincial election that's just happened in BC do you think were most significant to students? And do you think they were addressed to students kind of effectively?
That's a really good question. I do think that the issue of affordability was, you know, front and center in the provincial election and continues to be front and center in federal politics. Right now we have this sort of alignment as to what seems to be the sort of master issue. Obviously things like housing and immigration get sort of folded in to general affordability issues, and all of these things I think have some importance to students, whether they necessarily realize it imminently or not, is that, you know, students are, it's an interesting demographic because, you know, you're coming, let's say it's let's just assume undergraduate students, 18 to 22. First, like you said, it's your first engagement with the system as an eligible voter. You are very busy, you know, because often you're working a part-time job and you're studying. You're sort of transitioning into a new part of your social life, and that's also really important to you. So I do find that, you know, I do have a lot of students who are really interested to learn, but I do agree with you that it is interesting that they don't, people overestimate how much time students have to really spend learning the issues. And it's kind of unfortunate because I do think political parties tend to speak past them for that reason. And because of the other thing I didn't mention yet is that no matter what we do, it seems that younger people tend to vote less than older populations. There does seem to be, it's not perfectly linear, but there is a relationship between age and vote turnout. And I think, you know, behind the scenes, even though when asked, politicians will claim to speak for young people, but really they're more interested in putting forth policies and ideas that are targeted more to those who are 35, 50, even in, you know, the 55 plus group is a group that votes you know, quite substantively. So I think that, you know, if you look at how things are pitched, those are always in the background, because, you know, when we think about British Columbia, you know, no party was proposing you know, radical solutions to a problem that many young people walk around campus feeling, like housing, right? Something acute where they can't find rentals. The idea of even buying something, it's like, would be just unimaginable for most students, right? And, you know, if you look at both, all the parties talk about housing, but who are they really talking to, right, when it comes to the policy initiatives they're offering, right? Whether it's sort of, you know, tweaks on mortgage periods, whether it's you know, housing starts and things like this. It's not like, you know, okay, well, we need to create a segment of housing that's suitable for this younger population to sort of transition out of their parents' homes. How can we do that, right? It's more broad based. And again, there could be solid economic reasons for that, but I mean, I think students should expect that their politicians would speak directly to them, considering how important they are to the future of the province.
Yeah, and I think when you touched upon the fact that you're transitioning at that age to a different point in your life where it's kind of your learning goes way more independent, and trying to adjust to that, and it takes a lot of time to get used to. And when I was researching coverage for this election and reading the platforms, like, they're very extensive, the platforms that they put out. So you're definitely having to set aside a lot of time to go through each party's platform to properly educate yourself in what each policy is that they're proposing to have an informed decision. And most students probably will not have the time to be setting aside all of that in order to make an informed decision. So they probably just decide, well, I don't really know, so I would rather just not vote, which I find it's sort of similar back home. I would think that it's more with university back home, a lot of students in the UK are not commuters. And I know this university is a big commuter uni. So they have the added kind of transition of like cooking for themselves, living by themselves, dealing with bills and everything. It's very common to not be living at home whilst you're doing your degree, which I think contributes to back home, the voter turnout being so low like it is here for the 18 to like 24-year-old category is significantly low, because students are thinking, I've got so much going on and trying to juggle going from my parents cooking and doing my laundry and everything to doing it all myself on top of university, that unless politicians are speaking directly to the students, making it clear, like, we're talking to young people on this, and this issue, they don't have the time to kind of read between the lines and figure out what's relevant to them. Do you think that there are, aside from sort of that, particular barriers that prevent students from participating in voting?
From voting specifically, obviously, for some, the process of getting on the voter registration, it's not particularly complex, but I wouldn't say that Elections BC, you know, is particularly forthcoming with, like, you know, showing up to campus and making it easy for students who haven't voted before to tell them, you know, what they need to do. And even then, right, anybody who's a citizen of Canada with a BC driver's license or some kind of identification, you have to be a citizen, that is a requirement for voting here, could show up to a polling station where they live and sign up on the spot. But I don't think a lot of people know that.